Blog Talk Radio.
I may not have a license to kill, but liberalism dies a little every time I pull the trigger on it. This is a conservative's perspective.
If you had to bet $150,000 on who's going to win in November, who would you bet on?
I never dreamed that I would say this, but I would bet on Trump. I thought it was done. I thought it was over. You don't come back from an impeachment. You don't come back from January 6th. You don't come back from any of this. But he's come back. Guy's a survivor, and his opponent is having so much trouble that I would, at this point, give the edge to Trump.
Hey everybody, James Bostic here, a conservative's perspective on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio, Mojo50.com. Well, sad sack there. Frank Luntz, by the way, that's who that was, pollster, political analyst / hack. And if you could see, you could probably hear it in his voice. He's not a Trump guy by any stretch of the imagination. But he did have, at least in this instance, the intellectual honesty to see what we all see, I think. And he was really looking heartbroken over having to say, that he thought Trump was going to win. And it's a juggernaut, and you know what? If you stop and think about it, and just to prove my point when we say this, okay? I was just flipping through, or scrolling rather, down on Breitbart. Final Iowa caucus poll. The Iowa caucus is going to be on Monday. And they're in the middle of some terrible, I mean terrible, winter weather out in the Midwest. And looks like old man winter's becoming comfortably ensconced here in the mountain state of West Virginia as well. But we'll get to that after a while when we have time. Monday, the Iowa caucus is going to start. There's just a terrible storm. They've had lots of frigid temperatures and a boatload of snow. But it's not deterring anybody. And here's what the headline is. Final Iowa caucus poll shows Trump with the largest lead in Des Moines Register's final survey history. Now, I don't know how long that's been. We'll take a look at the article and find out. He made history Saturday as he prepares to romp in Monday's long-awaited Iowa caucus. The final Iowa caucus poll by the Des Moines Register shows Donald Trump at 48%, a whopping 28% higher than the nearest challenger. And it goes in this order. Trump at 48%, Nikki Haley at 20%, Ron DeSantis 16%, Vivek Ramaswamy at 8%, and Asa Hutchinson and some guy named Binkley, or chick, maybe it's Christy Binkley. No, that's Brinkley. Sorry. Anyway, a couple other also-rans in there that don't stand a rat's ass chance in hell anyway. So, he's killing him. He's killing him. His lead represents, as we said, the most lopsided advantage in the final pre-caucus poll in the history of the Des Moines Register's iconic projection. They don't tell us how long that's been, but evidently this is something that's never happened before, like so many things surrounding Donald Trump that have never happened before. What is it? In the end, though, what's it mean? Well, I think it means that tomorrow, Monday, the Hawkeye caucus is gonna those people are gonna gather. They're gonna caucus amongst one another, and all these people, you know, they're gonna take into account all the glad handing, all the flesh pressing, the baby kissing, the button handing out, all this mess, and they're gonna look at who they want. And I don't know why. It's a pulse point for the country, but it seems to be, I guess, you know, it's Iowa, it's the heartland, and it really truly is. And that's not cliche, that's not a pejorative by any stretch of the imagination. A lot of the left would see that, because that's why they call it flyover country, because the only reason you come in contact with or exposed to it is because you got to get from the East Coast to the West Coast and back and forth. But it is the heartland. And they're going to do what they did last time. And in this case, and they're going to do what, and what I mean by that is, they're going to do what they did last time like they do every other time. They're going to take a look at these candidates, and they're going to select who they think the guy should be. And obviously, they think that Donald Trump is the guy. And that's what we're going to see. Biden is in a lot of trouble. Now, we don't hear about it much on the news. We don't. But as we progress in this campaign season, there's going to be, by mandate, it's just going to have to happen, there's going to be more scrutiny given to Joe Biden and his age and his maladies. And we've talked about him a lot here. He's got a lot of crap going on medical history-wise. And none of it's good. None of it's good. None of it's going to improve either. So what that means is that every day, every hour, every minute, every second, it is progressively becoming that much more worse. That much worse. That much more worse. No, that's not what you say. It's becoming worser and worser. I know, my mom was an English teacher. Can you believe some of the crap that rolls out of me sometimes? I know, if she were here, I would be smitten, smote, smited. She would hit me. She would straighten me up. And but now, as the Democrats go, they have been in a quandary for quite some time. So what are they going to do with this feeble-minded, doddering old man? He says he's running again. He's the president of the United States. And now they're stuck between the hard place of secretly knowing he's gone. He's done for. He has been for a while. They can't keep this masquerade up for a whole lot longer. They just can't. And it's going to be seen more and more on the campaign trail, if that's what you're going to call it. I don't know that, you know, they're probably going to try and put him in the basement again or wherever he was, the bunker, the Biden bunker, like the Fredo bunker at CNN when, what was his name? Cuomo, the phony Cuomo, came out of that thing. He acted like he was in his basement the whole time, that he quarantined himself for like 28 days, and he come out like a groundhog or something. And it's like, okay, well, crap, now we're going to have another 2 years of bad television. Cuomo came out and saw his shadow. But so they're going to put him in the basement, and they're going to do remote interviews. They say, and this is another thing I want to talk about as far as what these people are going to do with Biden. One of the things they want to do is try to, how can I say, try to make him, they're worried about the image. They're, you know, the campaigns are all about images, and Joe Biden's got a lousy one, and it's his own fault because of the things he says or doesn't say or mumbles through or stumbles through or flat out just straight up falls over. And They're trying to rev him up a little bit. And one of the things that they're wanting to do is they're wanting to change the kind of venue that they try to showcase this guy in. And what they're thinking is going to work is they want to go ahead and go with smaller crowds, which shouldn't be much of a problem. If you watch the Valley Forge speech, there might have been a couple of hundred people there. And you'll notice that when they talk about Biden and speaking, they don't talk about standing room only. They don't talk about sellout crowds. They don't talk about people showing up 12 hours, 24 hours before the scheduled event to wait to get to see the guy. No, they don't talk about that. And the reason they don't talk about that is because that kind of response to a Joe Biden speaking engagement is non-existent. It's not going to happen. So what they want to do, and their thinking is, if they go with these smaller crowds, which they really don't have any choice because there's nobody, all the Democrat speakers put together on one jam-packed, star-studded speaking card wouldn't draw the people that Donald Trump gets. Okay, and he's going to places in the middle of nowhere, and they are coming from everywhere. Okay, it's not just major cities that Donald Trump speaks at. Donald Trump speaks at the smaller towns, and they go crazy. But here's what they're doing. They're thinking is they get him in these smaller crowds, and he can interact with these people on a more personal level. I don't want to say personable because, you know, he's the lion, dog-faced pony soldier. I'll do push-ups with you, man. I'll take you out behind the high school and whip your ass. And, you know, all these crazy-ass things that he says, you know, somebody rubs him the wrong way or he misunderstands a question and becomes irate. I don't think this is going to do anything. I think they're just stuck. They can't keep going around having him at these major engagements, shaking hands with invisible people and talking, you know, seeing dead people. And I think the one thing that probably drives him crazier than anything is he'll make his comments. He'll say, you know, thank you very much for being here. God save the Queen, man. And then Jill runs up and grabs him by the arm or the hand, whatever, and hugs him, gives him a little sugar cube, and then they... Sugar cube is jacked full of some kind of nootropic enhancer, and they try to get him off stage, and he'll stop. He'll stop, and he'll turn around because he thought of something. But, you know, he's going to lose that thought by the time he gets back to the podium, and then he comes out and he says, you know, like I said, God save the Queen, man. I'm Joe Biden, and I work in the Senate. Or, you know, I understand power, and make that crazy face. You'll come back up, and he'll whisper something. It's just nuts. And I know that his handlers go, oh, son of a... Here he goes again. Can we keep him away from the mic? Once he's finished, just walk him off. Pull him off. Whatever they got to do. But he'll think about something else he wants to say, and then he'll turn around and go back to the microphone. He's done that more than once. Or maybe he thinks he hasn't given his speech yet, and he's going to go back out and, you know, it's an embarrassment, and, you know, it's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, but I don't know how we can't talk about it. I don't know how we haven't been able to keep from talking about it as much as we have. And, you know, those guys just put a lid on crap. And then when you ask them questions, they kind of stonewall. And so I was just talking with a friend of mine, and we were talking about and everybody is. I mean, well, everybody's starting to. A lot of the people that I know, you know, the armchair pundits, which is what we are, the armchair commentators, you know, we're talking about this stuff, and I think what's going to happen is between, as the campaign ramps up, my original thought, we got lost on that. I'm going to pull a Michael Cutler and come back to it. All these Democrats, you know, all from the very get-go, from the beginning of the first campaign, running for president against Donald Trump, you know, Joe Biden is the greatest political mind since Gladstone or Benjamin Disraeli or Lincoln, whatever they want to say. And that's what they say to the public. When the public says, yeah, this guy's nuts and he's old and he's having trouble, what are you talking about? This is the smartest guy ever. He's a brilliant political mind. But to themselves they're going, when we point out these foibles and these frailties, these disqualifiers, you know, to themselves they're going, oh, when they hear us say these things, they're saying, oh my God, you don't know the half of it, you rube. If you knew how bad he was, you guys would have the hay rakes and the torches and pitchforks, and you would be marching down the beltway. And they're probably right. We don't know how bad it is. Like I say, when they send him out to speak at a Girl Scout cookie stand opening or whatever it is he's doing, you know, some kind of public service or fluff presidential ceremony, they've made a decision, right or wrong, based on what they have seen before this event or before, you know, it's in the, you know, before it's time to go, they've made a decision. Okay, he's as up as we're going to get him. Let's get him out here and let's get this stuff over with as quick as we can. Let's keep the organization and the choreography as tight and seamless as we can. We're not going to stop for anything. We're not going to ad-lib. And for God's sakes, once he moves away from that microphone, you think he's turning around to go back, just move behind him. Tell him we got to go get ice cream. Tell him something. And get him out of there. Because that's the best he's going to be all day. Anytime we see him in public. All right, and think about the times we've seen him in public that he's mumbled and fallen over and doddered around and looked like he didn't know where he was and trying to figure out what that big green thing with the whirly gig on the top of it was that he just got out of. It's tough, man. It's tough. And it's going to get tougher. And the establishment media is going to start showing more and more of this. They've tried to not talk about it, and when you ask them about it, they kind of shuffle papers and they stare off in the distance and they don't really respond other than saying, you know, nothing to see here. Don't pay any attention to all those men and women behind the curtain, like Valerie Jarrett, Barack Obama, and others of that ilk. Not dead air, man. I'm just taking a pause. And here's something else to ponder while we're kicking all this other crap around. Let's talk debate for a minute. Presidential debate. Not talking about the Republican also-rans debate. You know what? We haven't talked about that a whole lot, and we're not going to because it's meaningless. These guys never had a chance from the get-go. They're not there to be elected president or try to win. They're there to keep Trump from winning. That's their purpose. Make a little bit of money and then get out. That's it. That's all they're doing. So let's talk about presidential debate between the presidential candidates, which I'm guessing, well, for the purposes of our discussion, we're going to say it's Joe Biden. We're going to say it's Joe. We're going to say whatever. We're going to say it's Joe. And now, what about a presidential debate? And if they're not going to have a presidential debate, how will they spin that that's going to be believable? And it's not going to be believable no matter how they spin it. I mean, Peter Ducey, I got a clip. I don't know if we're going to get to it in this part of the show, but the other day he was all over John Kirby about this Lloyd Austin thing. And we'll get to that in the second half. But how's that going to work? Can you honestly see Joe Biden debating Donald Trump? What will they say? It's beneath the office of the President of the United States, the sitting president. It's beneath his dignity to debate, I don't know, what, Orange Man, insurrectionist, I mean, whatever you know, whatever they're going to say, and they're going to make it look like there's no legitimate candidacy in terms of Donald Trump. And so we don't have to debate him because he's not a legitimate candidate. It wouldn't be a legitimate debate. So we're not going to do it. Is he walking towards the microphone again? Get him away from that microphone. And Joe came up. I thought he was going to say something and came back. You know, and it's... So how are they going to do it? And who's going to buy it? Well, I mean, you know, any kind of thinking people don't buy probably 65, a good 65 to 79, 81% of anything any frickin' politician says, if you've got any brains in your head at all. I don't care if they're Republican, they're Democrat. A lot of times, conservative is not even, or traditional liberal aren't really reassuring titles of people being intellectually honest or not wanting to bamboozle you. So, we got a lot of politicians in Washington, D.C. We don't have a whole lot of statesmen, a whole lot of leaders. Donald Trump, I believe, is a leader. Ronald Reagan was a leader. Bill Clinton, I think, in his way, despite some remarkably, remarkably narcissistic flaws, was also a leader. He was a consummate politician, too. And he was remarkably adept at finding that middle ground. That's what got him two terms as president. But I don't see Joe Biden as a leader. I don't see Joe Biden as a statesman. I don't see Joe Biden as anything but a cut-rate politician who has spent his entire political career enriching himself and his family and his close cronies off the taxpayer's nickel. Do you? How do you guys see Joe Biden? What's he look like to you? Where are you guys at on this? Exactly. So how's that going to work? How are they going to do it? As if we need any more evidence of the fact that Joe Biden, even now as we speak, and probably has been for a while, I mean like during the first campaign that got him elected the first term, unfit to serve as president. He's got too many troubles, man. But we didn't have to worry about that because there were all these other untroubled people behind him making the serious decisions and manipulating and guiding and maneuvering him in the way that they wanted for, what, the third Barack Obama term? Yeah, kind of. That's pretty much it. Oh, man. Well, we've about knocked it out. We are at the 23-minute mark of a 24-minute, 50-second segment, so I got to wrap this up. We're going to come back and talk more about Lloyd Austin. That's some serious crap there. Peter Ducey, like I said, jumps up on John Kirby and wears him out with legitimate questions that John takes a long time not to answer. But a lot of times what these guys don't say and the way they don't say it is more important than what's, you know, than anything. So it's, you know, we'll be reading between the lines on a lot of that stuff. And it's easy to read between the lines on these guys because most of the stuff they say is basically all bullshit to start out with. So once they start talking, you know they're full of it for the most part. But we are going to delve into that. Where are we at now? Oh, wintertime's coming. Wintertime's here, man. It's like blue cold here in the Mountain State. It's been pretty mild up to this point, but we're looking at some snow coming over the next couple of days, and I'm happy about it because it's going to be a significant amount of snow. I'm hoping. The weather forecasters are calling for probably 3 to 6 inches, which is modest here. We can usually get a lot more, but it's a good start, and I'll take it. You're listening to A Conservative Perspective here on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you should be. The very best in conservative and libertarian talk radio, mojo50.com. Like I said, on the other side, Peter Ducey getting into it with John Kirby. Maybe drop in and see what J.P. Sears is doing, if anything at all. I haven't checked on him here in a little bit, and we need to do that. And if he's got something worth checking out, we'll take a look. Somebody else we haven't looked in on in a while, Neil Oliver, but we'll see what's going on. We will be back, as I said, with more of a conservative perspective right after these brief commercial messages. So for heaven's sakes, don't you go anywhere, and we'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. A conservative perspective here on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. Mojo50.com. Hey. Okay. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, all right, has prostate cancer. He's got to get it taken care of. So he goes to the hospital. He has it taken care of. Okay, great. I think he's still in the hospital. There's been some trouble there. Not exactly sure what's going on, but he remains in the hospital. Here's the problem. He goes to the hospital. He undergoes the procedure. I'm guessing it was for prostatectomy. And, again, I don't know for sure, but that would be the logical conclusion here. So he goes in for the prostatectomy. He has prostatectomy done, and he's in the hospital for 4 days. Now, as I get ready to tell you the rest of this, I want you to pause for just a moment and think about all the crazy things that are going on in this crazy world that might merit constant communication between the Secretary of Defense and the Biden White House. Look at what's going on in the Middle East. I know you can say, well, there's always something going on in the Middle East. And that's true. There is. Ever since I've been a kid, ever since there's been a Middle East, there's always been something going on there, okay? Syrians are mad at the Iraqis. Doesn't matter, you know. But and Ukraine, and who knows what else they're not telling us about? But you know, the world is a powder keg right now. There are a lot of places where there's a lot of problems that could easily escalate and become even more violent, even more bloody, even more horrific. The White House has no clue Lloyd Austin has been hospitalized. They don't, for 4 days, nobody knows. In the Biden White House, no one's known where the hell Lloyd Austin is. When we find out that Lloyd Austin has been hospitalized, because, you know, keeping a prostatectomy and the subsequent hospitalization and the previous diagnosis a secret is going to be pretty damned hard, especially for a guy like the Secretary of Defense, in this case, you know, Lloyd Austin. Nobody knows where he's at. Nobody knows what the hell's gone on. At first, they say it's an elective procedure, which, it's an elective procedure. He elected to do it so that the cancer wouldn't spread throughout his body and kill him. Okay, we got it. I understand that. But then we find out, you know, it's not liposuction. He's not getting a tummy tuck or a breast reduction or augmentation, as the case may be. You really just don't know. It's for cancer surgery. And nobody knows, in the White House, nobody knows where the hell he's been. He is still in the hospital. He has resumed some of his duties, according to sources at the Pentagon. And, you know, and, hey, they're not going to bullshit us, right? They're probably on. Oh, God. Austin, or the Pentagon says on Friday, Morning Joe, going to try and spin this thing as best they can. Major General Patrick Ryder says that Lloyd Austin takes complete responsibility for the failure to inform people of his absence, and this is a deeply personal issue. And we provided a lot of details in terms of the procedure that he underwent after having complications. Why couldn't you just pick up the phone? Mr. President, it's Lloyd. Lloyd Austin, your Secretary of Defense. Mr. President, yes, sir. Yes, sir. The black guy. Right. I'm having a problem with my... Lloyd Austin, your Secretary of Defense. I'm doing well, sir. Thank you. I am having a little bit of a problem, though. Turns out I've got a wee bout of prostate cancer, and I'm gonna get it taken care of. Not to worry, the doctors are confident everything's gonna be fine. We've caught it in time, but I have to have this procedure where they're gonna... Yes, sir, that's Lloyd Austin, your Secretary of Defense. Prostate cancer, yes, sir, that's right. And so he goes through this, but... And just say, hey, I'm having this done, and I'm going to be out for a few days. Well, thank you very much, sir. No, we have the deputy secretary will be running things, and we'll be in constant coordination as soon as I'm out of surgery and able to be apprised of what's going on. So, General Ryder, to a similar question that Morning Joe Scarborough asked him, he says, well, look, again, the secretary is taking full responsibility. I think it's clear that in the statement we issued from his doctors, it's a deeply personal issue. We provided a lot of details. And also, look, the Secretary of Defense is an extremely hardworking person, a dedicated public servant. I've been working with him for a very long time, and at the center of every day, he's focused on what he can do to help make sure our country's safe. So again, I'm confident going forward this will remain his focus. But to your point, we've learned some lessons, and we've committed to doing better in the future. We've learned some lessons and are committed to doing better in the future. Whiskey, Tango, Foxtrot. How bad, number one, how bad must the communications problems be between the Secretary of Defense and the Oval Office, between the Pentagon and the Oval Office, that they couldn't get somebody? If not going face-to-face would be nice, President, I'd like an appointment. Lloyd Austin, yes, sir, your Secretary of Defense. And talk to him early. Like I said, pick up the phone. None of that happened. No functionaries, no lackeys, no message boys, nobody saying anything to anyone. And again, as we're discussing this, and I don't think this was a communications breakdown. I just think that the people of the Pentagon decided that it wasn't important to let the White House know, that the White House would find out in good time. So I don't think there was a communications breakdown, and I think the lesson here is that there are people at the Pentagon that really aren't worried about the importance of communication between the Pentagon and the Biden administration. I think the lessons for us, lessons not for those guys, lessons for us. And that's the deal. Anyway, I told you earlier we had Peter Doocy, who is everybody. I like Peter Doocy. I like the old man. I thought, you know, they're okay. I mean, I think it's an example of nepotism working positively, because both those guys are pretty good journalists. Steve was a weatherman. And he brought the kid in. I can't remember. Steve's the old man. Okay. Pete Ducey's the boy. And he asks legitimate questions, which it is a pretty sycophantic press corps that we deal with, and I really don't see him as a sycophant. He asks some decent questions. They're not groundbreaking. They're not earth-shattering, but in light of the fact that nobody else is asking any hardballs, they seem even more impressive. Peter Doocy, John Kirby, earlier this week, talking about this really serious issue with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
Thank you. John, what kind of commander-in-chief is President Biden that at a time when American forces are under fire in the Middle East, he can go days without knowing that his defense secretary is in a hospital bed?
Peter, there's a lot to your question, so I want you to bear with me for just a second. First of all, at no time was the ability for the United States military to defend our national security interests compromised. At no time was the commander-in-chief not always in command and control of our military forces around the world. And over the course of those days, we did take military action, action that he approved, taking out a senior militia commander in Iraq with what we call a dynamic strike, a strike that he had approved many days before, which, for which the theater commander had full permission to execute. We did shoot down drones and missiles in the Red Sea, our ships at sea, because he made sure they had the existing authorities and the capabilities and the training to do that. So he has been on top of these issues all the way throughout. Now, look, what your question kind of gets to is, and I've seen some of the sniping out there, you know, how effective can the process be if the secretary can be gone and we don't know about it? I think what you need to understand, and what I hope people will understand, is that the national security decision-making process does not require, in fact, should not require, cabinet-level officials being the sole people in the room making decisions on any given day. You staff these things from the middle up, and then the cabinet officials, whether it's Secretary Blinken or Secretary Austin, come together as appropriate to make the key decisions, which happened. It happened on the 1st of January. If you'll bear with me, because I think your question really gets to a bigger issue, and I'd like to just, if I could, with Corrine's permission, I just want to walk you through a little bit of timeline here, because I think it's important context. So on the 31st of December, that was a Sunday, Jake Sullivan held a lengthy secure telephone conference with the Central Command Commander, General Kurilla, to discuss a bunch of issues, the situation in the Middle East, and of course there's a lot to that. The next day, on the 1st of January, President Biden convened a secure telephone conference with Mr. Sullivan, with Secretary Austin, with the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Brown, Secretary Blinken, the DNI, the CIA Director, and other members of the team. They covered developments in the Middle East. President Biden directed the NSC, Department of Defense, and the State Department to accelerate work with allies and partners on a joint statement on the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea, which was to be issued, according to the President's direction, no later than Wednesday. You saw we did that. I came to the podium and read that out. From Monday the 1st of January through Wednesday the 3rd, the National Security Advisor, his deputy, Middle East Coordinator Brett McGurk, spoke repeatedly with their counterparts in multiple foreign capitals to secure the support for that joint statement. Senior NSC officials coordinated hour by hour with senior Pentagon officials who are also making phone calls and securing support from foreign partners. The President's final approval on that statement happened shortly thereafter, and as you know, it was issued on the 3rd of January. Also on the 3rd, there was a Principals Committee meeting on Haiti, and neither Secretary Austin nor General Brown attended. They were represented by deputies. That is not uncommon, that a Principals Committee meeting, for whatever reason, the principal may not be able to attend.
Okay, thank you for all the detail on that. But more broadly, why should we believe anything that this administration tells us about anything ever again?
I think we all recognize, and I think the Pentagon has been very, very honest with themselves about the challenge to credibility by what has transpired here, and how hard it was for them to be fully transparent with the American people. I think we all recognize that. And wait, now just give me a second now. I know you got another one coming here, but we all recognize that this didn't unfold the way it should have on so many levels, not just the notification process up the chain of command, but the transparency issue. We all recognize that. And I think we all want to make sure we learn from that. It's up to you and your colleagues, and it's up to the American people to determine – you know, how much they're going to ascribe what happened here to our credibility on every single issue. But in every way, Secretary Austin has been an exceptional defense secretary, and he still has the full faith and confidence of the commander-in-chief. He has led the department at an incredibly dangerous time for our national security interests and those of our allies and partners.
But if the administration is going to go to such great lengths to keep secrets about the defense secretary's health, how can anybody be certain that the administration would not go to the same length to keep secret problems with President Biden's health in the future?
If you could logically argue, and you can't, but if you could logically argue that if the administration made some sort of Machiavellian effort across the board to keep this from getting public, then I think your question has merit and certainly is a fair one. I don't think it's a fair one because that's not what happened here, Peter. What happened here is the Secretary of Defense, for whatever reason, I can't answer the question why, that information wasn't shared. It wasn't shared widely in the department, and it certainly wasn't shared with the inner agency. It's not good. It's certainly not good, which is why, again, we want to learn from this. We want to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
This has never happened before, and the reason that it never happened before is very simple. It's because the people within the chain of command up to this point knew what the hell they were doing. They understood the protocols within this hierarchy, within this construct, and they behaved accordingly. The swamp, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, the shadow government, that, you know, these are terms we used to laugh at. What else can this be? Okay, if it's not incompetence, if it's not arrogance, then what is it? Design? Intent? How can it be anything else? I mean, it's got to be one of the two. And what does this say? Clearly, I think we all know what it says, really, about the level of respect that the people in the Defense Department have for the authority of the White House. Right? 4 days. Nobody in the White House knew what the hell was going on. Nobody. Or if they did, they didn't say anything to anyone. They kept to themselves because they were instructed to, or maybe, I don't know. I just don't know. All right? Same thing at the Pentagon. Now, if the Pentagon has this cavalier attitude towards the chain of command, What is the State Department? What's the State Department's attitude? I think we know what the Justice Department's attitude is. They're walking in lockstep. What about the Homeland Security? What about the Department of Homeland Security? And to say that the President still has full faith and confidence in the Secretary of State, I mean, in Secretary of Defense, which he has full faith and confidence in Alejandro Mayorkas as well, right? Sure he does. He's got full faith and confidence in Chris Wray, in Merrick Garland, in Pete Buttigieg. But is it severe? Yeah, it's severe. It's serious. They want to downplay this thing like it was a whoopsie, like it's just a little pothole that we hit, a little turbulence. This has never happened before. Four days. Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, can't pick up a phone, can't have somebody pick up a phone to call somebody in the White House who's in charge of picking up phones and handling things like that and letting somebody know. I mean, there's no trail. There's no caller IDs. There's no phone records. They didn't even try. There's not an email, or we would have known about it. There was no communication. There was no communication. And we really, if he's still in the hospital, we don't know how serious those complications that he's suffered and dealing with right now. And again, we are commanded by God to pray for his recovery, and that's what we do. But we don't know how serious it was. We don't know. I mean, obviously for a couple of days he's out of the loop because of pain-killing medications and because of the surgery itself. All right, so he's not in full retention of his faculties due to the necessities of the surgical process and the things that happened there. But he's still having trouble, and we don't know just how fully involved he is with day-to-day decisions. And they're not going to tell us, okay? Why? Because it's a deeply personal matter, and that should be enough. You had one major general telling us this, and then Kirby up there, I think, might have parroted that same line. It's one of their talking points. Jesus wept. Okay, we got to find a stopping place, or I'll be yammering about this for the next 8 minutes. And we want to spend a little time with JP Sears. He's got some good stuff going on. How to be a better victim, 2024. JP, break it down for us.
Here is an opportunity to create a new you. But unfortunately, it takes hard work, character, and grit to create a new you. So my sincerest recommendation is to let the new year be an opportunity for you to dedicate yourself to becoming a worse you. Today's episode is brought to you by the Democratic National Committee. And there's no better way to become a worse person than by making yourself a victim. So today I'll be giving you an instructional on the best ways to be a victim in 2024. Wish it was easier. When faced with a difficult situation or a challenge in your life, don't make the mistake of getting stronger to overcome it. Just wish it was easier. The science of wishing helps magically change your circumstances to be much easier for the flaccid person that you are to deal with them. Science says that wishing is 100% safe and effective. Compare that to the baseless claims that you can become stronger physically and psychologically. That's just misinformation. Label everything trauma. The beauty of the pop psychology that you study on Instagram is that it helps you take sound psychological principles and apply them in the most mindless way possible to validate your self-induced flaws. Therefore, if you experience something as insane and unbearable as an uncomfortable situation, just label yourself as traumatized. And then treat your trauma by bitching about it to anyone who's pathetic enough to want to listen to you. The New Year's Workout List Program. For nearly a generation, the most popular New Year's resolution is to start working out. But recent breakthroughs in the science of mainstream media have revealed that working out is rooted in far-right extremism and white supremacy. Yuck. It's taken until 2024 for people to be smart enough to realize that being weak because you refuse to exercise makes you stronger. 'Cause that definitely makes sense. So resolve to do precisely zero forms of exercise this year, because if you do, apparently you're a Nazi sympathizer. And by the way, if you're extremely anti-Israel, you already are. So enjoy that one, sport. Look for narcissism everywhere so you find it. Anytime you hear another person with the audacity to have free will, which compels them to say something that you disagree with, which is anything outside of the narrative that you worship, label them a narcissist. This protects you from the inconvenience of having to open the anus of your mind to let something old and rotten leave. Instead, you get to stay exactly where you are instead of moving forward. And just remember, you can't be a victim if you're making progress. Special note for conservatives. Up until this point, you probably think that I've only been speaking to maniac leftists. That's because I have been. But a special note for you, if you've unknowingly adopted the traditional leftist value of being a victim, you may have positioned yourself as a victim to the tyrants, the globalists, the corporate media, big tech, the medical industrial complex, the censorship industrial complex, the World Economic Forum, the corrupt Biden administration, the corrupt FBI, the corrupt DOJ, the corrupt CIA, government surveillance, the border crisis, the climate crisis fearmongers. Bill Gates and his forced medicating agenda. Bill Gates and his forced fake meat agenda. Bill Gates invading your life with Microsoft. Bill Gates' plan to block out the sun. Bill Gates buying up all the farmland.
What was I talking about?
Oh yeah, you might see yourself as a victim to those things. And you can keep doing that in order to hand your power over to them. Or you can live your life in a kind, loving, yet bold and fierce way so you're not consenting to their control over you, which they only have if you see yourself as a victim of them. So, do what you want with that. In conclusion, a new year and a worse you won't happen by accident. But these tips on how to be the best victim in 2024 will help you defy your own human nature and become worse beyond your wildest dreams and even beyond your wildest nightmares. Enjoy inflicting these strategies on yourself and have a great 2024.
By making a donation of your personal power to the DNC, you're supporting our cause of controlling you even more, which can only happen if you see yourself as a victim. Remember, Trump is bad. Outsource your power to us. It'll probably work out really well for you.
You know, I tell you, the thing of it is, when it comes to ridiculing the left and pointing out the lunacy and the maniacs that are involved with them, it's easy. They make it easy. They really, really do. But with a guy like J.P. Sears, who is incredibly smart, he makes it look even easier. And remarkably creative mind. J.P. Sears, Awaken with J.P. You can find him on YouTube. Please check him out. He's a funny guy. And he, even though you're laughing, he also gives you pause to think about things. Terrific stuff there.
Whatever happens, anybody hear anything? I guess they'll be coming out here soon as it gets warm. BLM. BLM been doing anything lately? Antifa? Have they been,
I don't know what's going on with them. They haven't been in the news yet, but I bet they will. Like I said, as soon as it starts warming up, it's an election year. I bet we see them again. I bet they come back bigger and badder, tanned, rested, and ready. And who knows who else will be there, not counting all these millions of men of military age that have been given carte blanche access to the United States through our porous border system, our open borders. We live in interesting times, America. By God, we do. We really, really do. I don't know what's going to happen. I know it's going to snow. I'm happy about that. We were talking about that earlier. And this time of year is just my bugaboo, and I guess I get on people's nerves talking about it the way they get on my nerves talking about it. People who lived in West Virginia all their lives, start to finish, and they are shocked and appalled that it gets cold and snows in the wintertime in West Virginia. Now, granted, we've had some remarkably mild winters over the last 5 or 6 years, which are the exception rather than the rule, but even then it happens. So we got some snow coming tomorrow on Monday, and I'm kind of excited about it. It's going to be Monday night into Tuesday, maybe 4 or 6 inches, I'm hoping, could be. That's, like I said earlier, kind of a modest amount for here because we can really get snow just like some of the places up north, I'm excited. I'm excited about it. That's all the time we got, guys. I'm going to go do my snow dance. You're listening to A Conservative's Perspective here on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be. The very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. That's all the time we got, guys. Thank you so much for the opportunity to hang out and talk with you. We'll be back next week taking a look at things as we do through